Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 58, Arms Race. The fort at St. John's was being used as a shipbuilding center for the British Navy up in the Great Lakes region since before the Americans invaded north. Of course, after Schuyler brought his men to the north, the two ships that they were building at St. John's were procured, air quotes, by the Americans. But once again, the British were hard at work building their ships. Now, some of the ships were going to be hauled overland from Chambly to St. John's, while others would be built right at the shipyards at St. John's. They were building gunboats. These were relatively simple designs and that the English could produce in good number quickly. Now, the gunboats were nothing more than a flat-bottom boat with a single sail in the middle, giving it the resemblance of basically a bateau. In the front, they would sport a single cannon at the bow of the ship. So the gunboats were relatively simple designs that were able to be produced quickly and were highly maneuverable on the lakes and the rivers of the Lower Richelieu and the Lake Champlain area, which would be really key in the battle itself, having large amount of fast-moving smaller ships to avoid some of the larger guns of the capital ships that the Americans would be sporting. That doesn't mean that they were wholly invested on using just these gunboats. One of the gunboats, and I don't know how they qualify this as a gunboat, but they do, it was the Thunderer. Yes, I said Thunderer. Don't ask me who came up with the name, but it had flat bottoms and flat sides. It was basically the same look as a barge that you would see today. It sported two masts, was 90 feet long, 33 feet wide, which was more than enough room for her complement of six 24-pound cannon and six 12-pound cannon. This was more like a floating battery, and she was definitely going to be the most powerful ship on the lake. How easy she would be to pilot, well, that's going to be another story, and the British would soon find out. An officer in the 31st Regiment of Foot had wrote a friend in England. What will seem the most surprising to you is that we are now hauling three large armed vessels overland for 12 miles to the lakes. What they were doing were they were taking some of their larger ships, schooners, and the like, and they were removing the planking, rigging, masts, anything that they could remove, I should say, and carrying them overland. Now, even with things like excess planking, rigging, the masts if they were lucky, the cannons, any of the extra supplies that were on board, all of that stuff have been taken off and moved overland. These things still weighed several tons, and they would have to move them through the forest of Canada, which would be an impressive task to say the least. Besides the Thunderer, the British also had two schooners, the Maria and the Carleton, the Maria being named after Carleton's wife. Now, besides those two, they also recovered in the records shows a gondola, but it's more of a row galley, and it's renamed the Loyal Convert. It was one of the ships that Arnold tried to run past the rapids on the Richelieu months past when the Americans were still in Canada, but it never got there. So the Americans left the ship behind, and the British took it and were able to get it overland to St. John's, where they converted it into a British warship. So those are their big ships. That is until we get to the Inflexible. The Inflexible was 180 tons. It was well over twice the size of the Maria, which was the flagship chosen for the fleet. This was no schooner. The Inflexible had three masts, square rigged. It was going to be the most impressive ship on the lake when it got there. It'll actually take a lot of time before the Inflexible could get to St. John's and then get work commenced on it, because it was just such a large ship and the framework was so large that the ship pretty much had to be taken apart piece by piece, moved overland, and then reassembled. Once the keel and the frame is kind of put together at St. John's, then work will begin, but that won't happen for some time. For when the Inflexible is ready, Lieutenant John Schrank of the Chauveau would be tasked with commanding it. I'm actually going to make a slight adjustment. It wasn't the Chauveau, that was a different vessel. The Chantio is the ship that Shrank will command. And it's not just him that is transferred to the Inflexible. It's all the expendable parts, because that ship was technically out of commission. Charles Douglas, who was basically the Commodore, the man in charge of moving all the materials and such, tells Shrank that he's going to move him to the Inflexible when she is ready to be put to the water. But we're also taking your rigging, your cannon, your supplies, oh, and even your crew. So everyone's just transferring to this new vessel. And that's what Douglas will do. Now, the one thing I didn't cover was who was going to command this, hodgepodge of a British fleet. And Douglas also had an answer for that. The man he would choose would be Thomas Pringle. This is the man that is going to lead the British fleet against the American fleet when we talk about the Battle of Valcour Island. So what is going on in the American camp? Well, first things first is that on July 10th, Colonel Thomas Hartley was sent to Crown Point by order of John Sullivan to find out any information that he could about what the British were doing. He needed to know, were they building a fleet? Were they marching over land? What were their numbers like? Anything. Benedict Arnold is still up there forwarding supplies to Fort George and to Fort Ticonderoga, and he and Hartley agree that the British were definitely in the process of building a fleet, and they were going to come south. Now, Arnold is very familiar with working on ships. He actually spent some time at sea when he was a younger man. This actually made him one of the most experienced mariners in the theater at the time. Gates wants him to come south. He feels that the production on the gondolas is not going fast enough. And he thinks that Arnold is the right man to get the production moving faster. Gates wants to maintain naval superiority. But the men can't get the gondolas rigged or armed fast enough. They're lacking in every type of naval store that you could imagine. Yeah, sure, there's plenty of greenwood to be had, but they have nothing to tie those pieces of wood together, nothing to seal them up, nothing to rig them with, nothing to make them sail with, and nothing to shoot at the British when they come. So he needs to find supplies. And for that, he would need special artisans. And lucky for him, he would get some help in the form of Brigadier General David Waterbury. Waterbury had arrived at the fort with 5,000 good men in mid-July. These were Connecticut militiamen, so they knew their way around boats and how to sail them and everything. Gates immediately sent them to Skenesborough to assist Hermanus Schuyler in shipbuilding. Waterbury was also a man of Connecticut and was familiar with sailing and shipbuilding, and was also asked for his involvement to help get this undertaking underway. Now, the Connecticut troops were there mostly to help with any tasks that they needed done, but the first thing they had to do was repair the roads and make them more accessible for carriages so that the supply and material could get to Skenesborough and not get held up in the woods. The Connecticut troops were also clearing Wood Creek to make it more open to boat traffic so that they could also move small supply boats up through Wood Creek to Skenesborough as well. The troops also built small fortifications around the mills to protect against Indian attacks. There were several tribes in the Iroquois Nation that we have talked about before were loyal to the British, and they were raiding the local settlements. Lastly, they were added to the – they pretty much added muscle for when it came to ship construction. They would get a couple of big, burly Connecticut men to hold up large pieces of wood so that they could be tied into the frame. So while Waterbury busied himself with infrastructure works, Hermanus Schuyler ran the shipyards. The forges and mills worked constantly, pretty much 24 hours. The slips were abuzz, with men assembling ships. Waterbury had wrote Gates soon after his arrival, stating, "I think the business is going very lively and according to the number of men." This was probably true, but Gates, for some reason, thought that the work wasn't happening fast enough, calling the men there lazy in a letter to Benedict Arnold. He's saying that they're not working fast enough, you need to do something. Gates and others were not also overly enthused about the quality of ships that were being produced. But, I mean, honestly, what did you think you were going to get with green wood? And the design was kind of ad hoc. They kind of went with whatever they could, the design that the shipbuilders knew how to build. But they were thinking that they were going to get these large roll galleys that they were producing down on the Delaware to protect Philadelphia. Philip Schuyler asked numerous times. He needed shipbuilders that were familiar with the construction of these roll galleys to be sent up to him, but they never came. So he was doing the best that he could, and the Patriots built the gondolas similar to the construction of the bateau that they were accustomed to building already. They just made them much bigger. Whether or not these ships were going to be effective was irrelevant. They were useless without rigging and cannon. Luckily for the Americans, by the end of the month, almost 200 shipbuilders had arrived to Skamesboro, and with this manpower, they began to turn out boats faster than they ever had. They had several ships in the stocks at any given time. But even that wasn't good enough for General Gates. A hard man to please, he was also unhappy about the inactivity with the existing fleet. Now let's remember, there are three schooners, the Liberty, the Revenge, and the Royal Savage, and then let's not forget the sloop Enterprise. Before the invasion into Canada, Jacobus Wynkoop was in command of the fleet on the lake. But in early 1776, William Douglas, yes, not to be confused with Charles Douglas, who was on the British side of things, was selected as the Commodore by Congress. But he never actually accepted the commission. See, Blue Water Navy operations had all the sex appeal, and the command on the lake offered little chance of glory, and for guys who were looking for a quick payday, also a chance at booty, because a lot of the ships on the lake didn't carry excess of supplies or anything like that. The large Blue Water Navy carried rum, money, supplies, everything that they would need to be at sea for several months at a time. So if you attacked at one of those ships of the line or the large men of war, you were in for a large payday. The ships on the lake were open bateau-type boats or these rogue galleys or some very small sloops and schooners that didn't offer much glory or prize money for taking them. So Douglas kind of just doesn't say anything about it. Schuyler, becoming fed up, ordered Wynkoop to Ticonderoga to take command of the lake fleet in May. Now, July, the fleet is still anchored at Ticonderoga. This was due in large part to the ships they were disarmed to be used as transports during the invasion. The ships didn't need guns because there was no enemy between Fort Ticonderoga and the invasion army up in Canada. So to save on weight and space, they ordered the ships to be removed of all their cannons. Now, why, and I can't figure this out in the least, and everything I've seen, they weren't rearmed because they had a lack of carriages. If you took the cannons off the boat, what'd you do with the carriages? Where did they go? It's very hard to lose a 500-pound piece of wood. I mean, that's what all it is. It's 500 pounds worth of wood that holds up a 2,000-pound cannon. So where did the carriage go? So can't figure that out in the least. But that's what's happened. The ships have no guns. So what are you going to do with the Navy with no guns? You can't do anything. Well, Gates acted immediately and ordered carriages built on July 16th. The Royal Savage was the first to be outfitted, receiving 4- and 6-pound guns. Once she was ready, she was sent to Crown Point, where Gates felt she would be in a good position to counter any British ships that ventured south. Not a large fleet, but it's good enough to chase off some small longboats or some small bateaus, that anything that the British might send south to investigate what the Americans are doing. Gates was still not happy with the pace, the way things were going. Remember, at Skamesboro are now Hermanus Schuyler, David Waterbury, and Cornelius Wynkoop, the brother of Jacobus, were all sent there to speed things up. Cornelius Wynkoop was sent not long after Waterbury's men because he was an experienced shipbuilder. And the thought was that, well, maybe he can make production go even faster. But again, wasn't fast enough for Gates. So he writes Arnold, "I wish you were here to give directions for putting our whole squadron afloat. It seems to me that they are very tardy about it. I am entirely uninformed as to marine affairs. What he's basically saying with that last part is he has no idea about how to run a blue water navy or a lake navy or any navy. That being said, he needs an experienced mariner. And Wynkoop, he knows some stuff. Jacobus Wynkoop, he was okay, I guess. Hermanus Schuyler was, like his brother, a supply man moving supplies up and down river, knew how to build bateaus, knew how to operate on the rivers, doesn't know how to fight in a navy. David Waterbury is a soldier. So, on July 23rd, Benedict Arnold arrived at Skenesborough on orders from Gates. Upon his arrival, Hermanus Schuyler had just sent the fourth gondola to Ticonderoga and reported that two more were ready within a few days. The problem was that none would be ready without the necessary cordage, blocks, or anchors. Arnold also inspected the ships that were in the slipways. There were two more gondolas to be built, and the third was the cutter that was sent down from St. John's before Arnold evacuated the fort earlier in the year, and the fourth slip under construction was a Spanish galley. This was way more the style of row vessel that Schuyler was after. The galleys were 70 feet long, they had rounded bottoms, elevated quarterdeck, they looked more like a ship of the line. The galley had covered gun ports to protect the crew, while the gondolas were more open. They had a small awning to protect the crew from small arms, but it wouldn't do much good against cannon fire. Galleys were also considerably more well-armed. They were still sporting similar 9, 12-pound guns, even some small 6 and 4-pounders, but the fact was is that they had more of them, whereas the gondolas just carried 3 guns, 2 on the sides and 1 on the front of the ship. The galleys carried several, depending on – each galley was different, so they each had different set of ordnance, and we'll talk about that more in the next episode, but these vessels were definitely more so what the Americans were looking for than the gondolas. So Arnold went to Hermanus Schuyler and told him once the gondolas that were in the slips were complete, they were moving on to large vessels. There was still the problem of supplies. They had almost no oakum, cordage, block, tackle, sailcloth, any of this stuff. Everything was in short supply. And Arnold decides that he's going to send word to his buddy Washington, who worked with them to find a quartermaster in New York. See, remember, this is still early summer 1776, so Washington is still in New York City, and so he still has control of the city. And so it's actually Washington that helps Arnold find the necessary supplies and sends them up to him. But then there's another problem. Along with the shortage of supplies, there was another shortage – sailors. Gates figured that they would need about 380 men. Now, this was going to be a rough estimate, looking at the ships that they have, the ships that they're building, and enough room for possible ships that they can build in the future. And he came up with this number about 380 men. I rounded it more towards 400 if looking at some of the numbers that Gates may have been looking at in some of the primary sources. 400 was probably the magic number they were looking for. And upon first request of volunteers in the Northern Army, the entire Northern Army, some 5,000 or so men, they got 70 men. So Gates and Arnold went to Congress and to Washington, and Congress was able to find them money for a bounty for able seamen to head north. And slowly but surely, the men were getting – they were getting the men that they needed to man the boats. So that's where we're going to leave it this week. A little bit of housekeeping, because since the beginning of, or the beginning part of this episode where I started talking about the Americans, I mentioned Jonathan Sullivan. Jonathan Sullivan gets kicked around a lot because he went up towards Canada, will be down here for part of the summer, and then remember he resigns his commission and heads when Gates arrives and heads back to Washington's army. And that's where we kind of see him during the whole Battle of Brooklyn. So he kind of just fades into the background at this point. So that's just a little bit of housekeeping that I wanted to just get out of the way. Well, I'm actually sorry for the slight delay. I got caught up with some work I was finishing. I was planning to do the episode on Monday or Tuesday morning, but summer school is winding down this for the summer school is winding down for the summer. I only have one more day after today, so I will be finished with that, and then I have a couple of weeks off before the new school year begins. So that's where we start to fall back into the flunky schedule of whenever I get the episodes out. My plan is to every week post an episode, or at least try very, very hard to. With the exception of holidays, my plan is to make sure I have that episode out every week up until April of next year, where we will discuss when that gets much closer, why I will be taking the entire month of April off. But my plan is to do that, and I really want to just thank everyone for bearing with me with my funky schedule. I'm never consistent with when I have the episodes out, but I've, since moving, starting this new job and everything, my schedule has been very consistent of me putting an episode out a week, which is the most important thing, to make sure the episodes get out every week. And I want to thank everyone that really sticks with me with my funky schedule. I know I'm not as on point or on schedule. I have a set schedule like some other podcasts you might see out there. So I just, once again, want to thank everyone for doing that. Next week, we're going to start talking about our change in leadership. We're going to see a strong change in leadership for the Americans. And so we're going to get into that next week. And before I sign off completely, I just want to thank everyone who liked the all the new people who are liking the Facebook page. Remember, Facebook page, you look for American Revolution Podcast. It's in there. If you're having trouble, the picture is the Join or Die flag. The background is the Saratoga Surrender painting by John Trumbull. I leave it open for anyone who has questions, but just seeing that people are liking the Facebook page shows that there is support for the Facebook page. Once again, if you have any questions, that's what it's there for. And as always, please put up a 5-star rating. Those work fine. It just there to get my message out there, get the Facebook, podcast, more views on iTunes. The more 5 stars I get, the more people they say, hey, you'll like this because a lot of people like it. If you are so inclined to leave a review, that's perfectly fine. It's really up to you. But just having that, having people throw up the 5-star is a really big thing for us. So if you don't mind doing that. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And I'll be back next week where I talk about the switching command structure for the American Lake Navy. Till then, as always, keep that powder dry.